We now take you to Constitution Hall at the Civic Center in Lansing.
President, I move that the regular order of business be temporarily postponed and that the convention receive an address by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, former President of the United States.
Without objection, those will be considered. Hearing no objection, it is. Chair recognizes Mrs. Butler.
Good morning. Here in Convention Hall in downtown Lansing, the Constitutional Convention is convened and the delegates are in their places. They have just held their roll call and have just declared that a quorum is present, and we are about to hear the invitation to former President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, to enter the Assembly Hall here, where he will face a battery of reporters and will address the delegates and answer their questions in a later part of the discussion. On the rostrum is the president of the Constitutional Convention, Stephen S. Nisbet, and he has just appointed a committee to escort the former president to the floor. And the committee is just leaving the convention floor now to go to President Stephen Nisbet's office, which is just across the hall, and in a moment we'll have the appearance of the former president. His appearance here is at the invitation of the convention. He's one of three former presidents invited to speak to the convention. President Harry Truman has accepted an invitation to appear sometime in January, although the exact time has not been set. President Herbert Hoover has also been invited to address the convention, and there has been no word from him as to his decision in that matter as yet. This is a gala day in the convention. There are reporters from all over the state. There's live television here. WMSB and WKAR Radio are feeding a network of television and radio stations across the state for this very important address by the former President of the United States. After he completes his address this morning and answers the questions of the delegates, President Eisenhower will go out to Michigan State University, where he will be the guest of Michigan State University President Dr. John A. Hanna, who is a delegate to the convention. And then he will address the students and faculty of the university, after which he will return to the airport and board his plane for the return trip to Gettysburg. Under the ground rules of the convention, established just this past week, there will be a period of about 5 minutes after the president enters the hall in which photographers will have an opportunity to photograph the president. Then they will leave the floor. Let's go to the rostrum and get the instructions of the photographers now.
Will you please observe that?
Oh, we just missed it. That was President Nisbet telling the photographers that he will raise his hand after they have had an opportunity to take their pictures of the former president, and then they must leave the floor.
The chair also now recognizes
the delegate from the 18th Senatorial District, Mr. Romney. For purposes of making an introduction, Mr. Romney, will you approach the podium, please?
Delegate George Romney is making his way to the floor now. It was at Mr. Romney's invitation that General Eisenhower decided to make this address today. He headed the committee which made the arrangements, and he has just come to the rostrum to join President Stephen Nisbet there and will be the one to introduce the General Eisenhower when he enters the hall. Vice President Romney also will present a gavel to the president. There will be a reception of delegates at the podium after the address has been made. Each will have an opportunity to shake hands with General Eisenhower.
They're coming in the door.
We have the word that the former president is just coming in the door now.
Permit them to approach the rostrum. Say that.
Standing ovation from the delegates, the former President of the United States, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, has entered Convention Hall and is now standing on the rostrum. With him is the President of the Convention, Stephen Nisbet, and the Vice President, George Romney.
Mr. Romney.
Photographers are taking their pictures. Mr. Romney comes to the microphone now to make his introduction.
Mr. President, Governor Swainson, honored guests, including our wives and staff, delegates. It is my high honor to introduce the Honorable Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Governor Swainson, President Nisbet, Mr. Romney, and delegates to this convention and honored guests. By the terms of the invitation that I received from this convention by the hand of Mr. Romney, I have the honor of speaking to you briefly as you meet in the bipartisan purpose of rewriting the Constitution of the great state of Michigan. Such a purpose, pursued in such a setting, cannot fail to bring to me, as an out-of-stater, renewed respect for my late friend, Senator Arthur Vandenberg, as the first individual of our nation to give true significance and real depth to the concept of bipartisanship in our country's international affairs. It would be strange indeed if any of you engaged in this worthy effort should fail to feel a sense of guidance from his spirit and his mature wisdom. I am certain that all of you here are convinced, as I am, that his passing was a grievous loss to his state, his nation, and indeed the world. Because in political work at the state level, I have had no experience whatsoever, it would be far from fitting for me to urge upon you any notion of mine respecting either the form or content of the document you were engaged in preparing. But since I did have the privilege of serving for 8 exciting years as head of the federal government, it might be appropriate to you for me first to express to you some personal thoughts as to the desirable relationships between state and federal levels of government in this nation. The several states, at least the first 13 of them, are the collective parents of the federal government. Our Constitution recognizes that each of them possesses a sovereignty limited only by the special grants of authority given by them to the central government. If it were possible for us to have here, at this moment, a temporary reincarnation of any one of the framers of our Constitution, telling us with what care those men defined this relationship and how they believed it would develop, I'm quite sure that we would be astonished by the differences in his
vision in 1787 and the reality of 1961. By the same token, our spiritual visitor would be bewildered, if not dismayed, by the result he would see around him. For example, some years ago, a court decision extended the meaning of that section of the Constitution which accords to the Congress the power to regulate commerce among the several states, so as to include in the term interstate commerce also those things that affect such commerce. The changes that have grown out of that decision are indeed great. For the better or for the worse is here beside the point. But because we are bound by the judicial interpretations made of any part of the Constitution, the effect has been to place in the hands of the central government more power over the nation's internal commerce than was previously and popularly supposed to have been intended. So, as you set about the rewriting of your Constitution, it seems to me you must take account of other governmental changes in our nation. Such an examination is timely, and I have felt, and surely you have felt, that there are tendencies developing that affect adversely our cherished ideas of government and tend to revise the structure built by those who preceded us. Of those principles, I refer specifically to one drawn from the colonists' bitter struggle against tyranny and from man's progress from serfdom to liberty and to self-government. That principle is this: those who would be and would stay free must stand the eternal watch against undue centralization of power in government. Faithful to that principle, our founders saw to it that governmental authority would be diffused, counterbalanced, checked, hedged about, and restrained so as to minimize the possibility of its abuse. In that principle, in those precautions, we have believed was established the true anchor of our freedom. Due to our decentralized system, most political and economic questions can be approached in many reasonable ways. With our constitutional checks and balances, with our state and territorial governments, our multiplicity of county and municipal governing bodies, with our emphasis upon individual initiative and community responsibility, there is encouraged unlimited experimentation in the solving of America's problems. And through this diversified approach, the effect of error is restrained. Calamitous mistakes are avoided, and the self-governing genius of our people is perpetually renewed. In this vast system of self-government, the state echelon is of vital importance and was so recognized by our forefathers. Being accustomed to decentralized authority, we are too often inclined to accept it as an ordinary fact of life and to assume that it will always endure. But in other lands, millions, helpless before concentrated power, have been born and lived and have died in slavery, or have lost their liberties to despots. Today, in those areas, anyone who speaks does so as the government directs, or he speaks no more. A meeting such as this one would be unthinkable in those regions. Contemplating these things, we in America gain renewed determination to hew to the principle of diffusion of power, knowing that only thus can we be assured to avoid drifting irretrievably, even though so slowly as to be almost imperceptible, into the grasp of some form of centralized government. Our governmental system has survived longer than any other attempt to conduct a nation's affairs by the authority of the people themselves. Yet we have often been cautioned by responsible observers that in the measurable future, if present trends continue, the states will finally become nothing but powerless satellites of the national government in Washington. The tendency of bureaucracy to grow in size and power does not bear the whole of the blame for the march of political power toward Washington. Never under our constitutional system could the national government have siphoned away so much state responsibility and authority without the neglect, acquiescence, or unthinking cooperation of the states themselves. Every state failure to meet a pressing public need has created the opportunity, developed the excuse, and fed the temptation for the national government to poach on the state's preserve. Year by year, responding to transient popular demands and localities seeking special advantage, the Congress has increased federal functions. The pendulum of power has swung far from our states toward the federal government. 8 years ago, I publicly expressed the conviction that unless we preserve the traditional power and responsibilities of state government, with revenues necessary to assure exercise of that power and discharge those responsibilities, there will not forever be preserved the kind of America we have known. Eventually, we shall have, instead, another form of government, and therefore, quite another form and kind of America. That conviction I hold just as firmly today. In that same year, I obtained congressional authority to establish a commission to study and report on intergovernmental relations. The study brought long-needed perspective and pointed the way to improvement in areas of mutual concern to the states and to the federal government. Unfortunately, sound recommendation and resultant action are not always the same. Opposed though I am to needless federal expense and centralization of power, I found it necessary at times during my terms in the presidency to urge federal action in some areas traditionally reserved to the states. In each instance, state inaction or inadequate action, coupled with undeniable national need, forced emergency federal intervention. But I tried to keep the word emergency of real significance in such legislation so that the invasion, which I felt forced to accept, would not be of long duration. These recommendations apply to such problems as classroom shortages, slum clearance, urban renewal, relief in the case of natural disasters, and matters of traffic safety. In varying degrees and varying circumstances, both federal and state responsibility in some types of activity has been, is now, and will continue to be indispensable. But I would urge that the states insistently contend for the fullest possible responsibility, well knowing that with responsibility there goes in the long run authority. Take the matter of traffic safety. This, happily, is still a state and local responsibility. But day by day, the American people are paying a fearful price for the failure of the states to agree on such safety essentials as standards for licensing of drivers and vehicles and basic rules of the road. Each year, from 35,000 to 40,000 persons are killed on our highways, 1.5 million citizens injured, of whom many are disabled for life. In addition, the estimated cost to the country in the year 1956, for example, was almost $5 billion. We simply cannot let this go on. The human and material costs of inaction are prohibitive. who is going to fill the vacuum? Someone must and someone will. I believe that the federal government has a function, but only as a leader and a coordinator. The basic responsibility and authority should be with the states, among which there should be effective cooperation. I believe that the preservation of our states as vigorous, powerful governmental entities is essential to permanent individual freedom and to national growth. But it is idle to champion states' rights without upholding states' responsibilities as well. So I hope that the rewritten draft of Michigan's Constitution will define carefully the responsibility that its people believe should belong to Michigan, and that they will forthrightly assume and exercise the authority essential to the carrying out of those responsibilities. So acting, they will do something positive and effective about problems that directly concern their fortunes, their welfare, and their lives. Of and by and for themselves, they will be using their money, improving their present, exploring their future, as these things can never be done by a distant and centralized bureaucracy, always preoccupied with its own amplification and the manufacture of inflexible master plans for the infinitely varied circumstances of 50 sovereign states and many thousand communities. The responsibilities best exercised by the people of a state can be returned to them in all 50 states, and Michigan can lead the way. The only limit placed by the Constitution on the kind of state government established by its people is that it must be in Republican in form. I believe, therefore, that this body, awakened to the trends of our time, has an opportunity to establish greater respect for the vital place that state government has fulfilled in our national development. Michigan's example of self-examination and its assertion of responsibility and authority could lead to like action in other states of the Union. And my friends, let us not forget that the American people are not completely dependent upon congressional action to accomplish any amendment in the national Constitution if they should believe such action desirable. On the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, the Congress is compelled to call a convention for proposed amendments. It is quite clear that if 2/3 of the states wanted our Constitution so amended as to define more exactly proper relations between the federal and state governments, they could accomplish this by calling such a convention and gaining the approval of 3/4 of the states. Now, a final word, which may be shooting far wide of the target at which you are aiming. It is my hope that in its preamble or in its accompanying documents of your new Constitution, there will be greater emphasis placed, particularly before our young people, on the opportunities before them than merely upon the problems and fears of our age. The hope of lifelong individual security is a natural one, but it is not an inspirational impulse. It does not encourage exploration, venturesomeness, ambition. Unless the individual is inspired to dream, to work and accomplish according to his own needs and desires, he will be courting a dreary, dull, and eventually an insecure life indeed. I pray that the language of your new Constitution will bring to its people a message of hope, a feeling of greater courage and confidence, a pioneering urge to sustain and enjoy freedom to the full. Put it this way. If our people are to be tireless, two-fisted champions and workers for America's great goals, they should have two-fisted, sturdy, alert, and tireless state governments to preserve their opportunities and give them a real example. And I should add, my friends, Merry Christmas.
Very fortunate that after this inspiring talk that General Eisenhower has indicated a willingness to answer questions. And as the delegates know, we agreed that questions would be filed with the Public Information Committee by Monday night. Now, a number of questions have been filed, and those delegates filing such questions will be asked to state their questions first. Following that, time permitting, other questions will be permitted from other delegates. And I will call on delegates in the order in which I've been given the questions by the Public Information Committee. Delegate Kuzi.
Delegate Kuzi, Grand Rapids, Michigan. General Eisenhower, would you care to comment on the implications of the Baker versus Carr case, the so-called Tennessee apportionment case now before the U.S. Supreme Court? I am not asking that you state your views on any decision the court may render, but rather on the implications that the appealing of this case to the federal Supreme Court may portend in regard to federal-state relationships.
Don't believe I could comment usefully on the very last part of your question, what this distribution may portend. I do believe this. This is largely a state business, of course, and my idea is merely a personal one. There is, of course, first of all, the obvious distribution according to population alone. But over through great areas of the United States, we also have great problems of distribution. Now, as I understand it, each man in a legislative bureau or a body is to represent the views of people of a region. If these people are difficult to reach, it is obviously more difficult for him to represent them accurately if he does it completely by the population ratio. And I would think, therefore, that there must be a good common sense compromise, although I think always the great weight would be according to numbers. But certainly, if you have a big, great city, you can much more easily reach those people than you can by through large districts where populations are sparse. I think there's got to, as I say, I believe the basic thing must be population, the rest of it as some modification to because of special conditions.
Thank you, sir.
Delegate King.
Raymond King, delegate from the city of Pontiac. General Eisenhower, the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution, as you know, provides that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. My question is, what special responsibility, if any, does this amendment place upon us as delegates to a state constitutional convention?
My goodness, I gave my whole talk on that one. Matter of fact, I suspect from the character of your question that you're thinking exactly as I am, and that is that the states themselves do have a great responsibility, because if you duck your responsibilities, then it goes to the federal government, and along with that, finally, authority is bound to go. You cannot give all your tax money to one central authority and then suppose that the people of the United States are not going to call for an accounting of the way this is done. Well, once you have to account for the way you distribute this money, that's authority in the federal government. And so I would think that the convention would want very clearly to spell out what they think their authorities and their comparable responsibilities are in this field.
Thank you, sir.
Delegate Blandford.
Delegate Blandford from Grand Rapids, Michigan, General Eisenhower. I believe my question has been fairly well answered already with your first answer, but this is it. As you well know, of course, having worked 8 years with Congress, and many of us wished it could have been longer, the...
Thank you.
The House of Representatives is elected on a population basis, and the Senate, of course, is elected on an area basis with two senators from each state. This results in a diffusion of power. In your judgment, is this system, electing one house by population and the other by area, a sound method of selecting a legislative body?
Well, now, first I'll comment on your comment, then I'll try to answer your question. You said that many of you wish that I could have stayed there more. I will point out, I believe it is a Republican pressure that made it impossible for me to try.
One of our errors.
Let us remember this. The states were entities in themselves and believed they were sovereign entities before they established the federal government. So their compromise of demanding that while the House could be organized on the basis of population in several states, each state would have two senators. I think that this was, and I think the reading of the papers at the time would corroborate this belief and this opinion, that they were anxious to keep the proper sovereign power in the states, except that given specifically. And if they had equal representation, each as a state rather than as a group of people or a size of people, this was the compromise they believed in. Now, when you go to applying this same principle further down, I'm not so certain of my ground, and I don't believe I could quite go along, for the simple reason that a county or a subdivision of a state is not sovereign, and I would believe that that the practice of using population as the principal factor in producing a representative legislature is good. All those I remarked before, I think other factors must be taken, particularly distribution, population.
Thank you.
Delegate Pretty.
Delegate Pretty from the Hillsdale Branch Representative District. General Eisenhower, in your masterful address, you commented that Michigan had an opportunity to lead the way. Let us assume that this convention assumes that role of leadership and recommends to and the people adopt a constitution designed to strengthen government at the state level so as to reverse this trend toward greater centralization at the federal level. Let us further assume, which seems obvious, that these state services would require additional state revenue from taxes. Do you know of any way that the citizens of this state could be relieved from the portion of the federal tax burden to offset the increased state tax burden that would result?
I don't want to be too sure of an older man's failing memory. I have constantly urged that as the states took back more responsibility, they should have some revenue. I remember in one instance, I forget what the power he wanted to give back but it did. We were going to give back the tolls on telephone calls, taxes on those tolls. Now, whether or not we thought it was possible to give him back to a specific state rather than to the generality, I don't recall, and I wouldn't want to be too positive in my answer, but I do say this. I believe if you set before the United States a real shining example of self-dependence, individual initiative, in other words, a true example of Americanism as we have believed it has existed and has brought us to this stage of our development, I believe you're going to get a lot of other states excited, and pretty soon you might have it easily in your power to make this correction apply to all the states rather than merely to one, and that, of course, would be the ideal.
Delegate Tweedy.
Delegate Tweedy from the St. Clair Sand Lac Representative District, and specifically from Port Huron. General Eisenhower, generally speaking, what length of term of office do you feel is best for the heads of executive department, and what factors should be considered in determining this length?
Of executive department length.
Oh, yeah, and the governors you're talking about?
That's right.
The governor, specifically.
Well, personally, I think 2 years is too short for any elective official, certainly above the city level. I believe that both governors, of course, this is state's business, and I don't want to be invading that even in advice, but I think 2 years is too short. In this day and time of almost instant communications, where anyone in public office is brought much closer to the people than he ever was before, I believe that it should be at least 4 years. Along with this, I believe that we should have a constitutional amendment someday to make a congressman's term 4 years, being elected at the same time as the president, rather than to have the 2 years and running back and thinking every single instant of campaigning. That just isn't good practice, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Delegate Bentley.
Mr. President, that's a habit I got into in Washington, sir. I'm not prepared to abandon it. Do you think this has been touched on, of course, sir, in your speech and also by Mr. Pretty's remarks, but do you think the federal government can and should return many of its functions to the states, and along with additional sources of tax revenue, do you have any further specific suggestions? I recall, sir, that in 1957, I believe, you did make a very specific recommendation to the Council of State Governors about returning the long-distance tax on telephones, and I'm wondering if you have any other suggestions, principally in those areas in which you said you felt, while president, compelled to act in areas that had formerly been reserved to the states.
Well, we're talking now about getting back the revenues. This is, of course, a very tough thing, and that's the reason I believe it's going to take a very positive and definite action. Whenever any level of authority has gotten its hands onto that part of the treasury and of our tax money, they are not going to give it up very easily. But I believe that the pressures can be brought so that it will. Now, I think there's a lot of things. Remember, the federal government lives largely upon income tax. It lives on profits. They have to be profits. But it should, I think, not constantly seek to invade these areas which have been traditional with localities and states of sales taxes and excise taxes of all kinds. I think that the best way it could be done would be an agreement into the fields of taxation. States, naturally, and localities get tired of trying to live on just on property taxes. The owner of a farm, and I'm one of them, believes that the taxes go up too highly to do these local things. So I think that a good study will have to be developed for the fields of taxation that properly, or let us say, primarily belong to the several echelons of government before we're going to get into them. Now, in the meantime, I think it's all sorts of things, of everything from schools to urban renewal and every kind of problem that has been too much neglected in the states and has gone along to the federal government with the money. And I think both should be brought back.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Delegate Higgs.
Milton Higgs, delegate representing Bay County. General Eisenhower, during the period of your presidency, it seemed to many that you exercised a great deal of restraint in the use of federal power in domestic crises. Would this have been based upon a faith in the power of the people through state and local units of government to solve such problems? And do you feel that such a faith was justified in the light of subsequent events?
Well, I would say that's almost a principal tenet of my political faith. I believe that with Jefferson, that government that is closer to the people is the best. Whether it is in welfare or any other kind of governmental activity, development of roads, public buildings, and everything else, if the people close by see it and are paying for it, I think there's always greater efficiency. I do not have very great respect for bureaucracy's efficiency in the handling the business of affairs that range all the way from Seattle down to Pensacola. This is there's many, many problems that are so localized and or are so colored by the locality that we need more of this kind of government and less of the centralized. Now, if the only time I can recall to intervening with force was when I sent troops to Little Rock. And there was a very definite principle involved. There was a properly issued order of a federal court. And the federal court had approved a plan of the locality, that is, the school board and so on, all is in accordance with the Supreme Court's decisions. The President of the United States is sworn to defend the Constitution of the United States and to execute its laws. Now, if any mob action, organized or unorganized, or indeed a local National Guard, tries to get into the way of a federal court's order being properly executed, then I think the president has no other recourse but to intervene. But I do say that we must recall this. I think it was Wilson said a very beautiful phrase of his. The highest form of efficiency is the spontaneous cooperation of a free people. If we're going to live with freedom, venerate it, and depend upon freedom, and preserve it, we must not lose this faith on the ability of the locality to handle its own affairs to the maximum. Now, I do not mean to say there are not certain federal functions. Of course there are. But it's always a better relationship if the federal government has to come in, is to study with the state and the locality to see what are the problems, and then let's cooperate. Let's have a proper field or sector allotted to the federal government, but my goodness, let's don't surrender our responsibilities and our opportunities to better ourselves to the hands of someone sitting in Washington 3,000 miles away or less.
Thank you, sir.
Delegate Sharp.
Delegate Sharp from Shiawassee Representative District. General Eisenhower, According to the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Abraham Ribbentrop, the federal government attempts in a constantly expanding welfare program. They anticipate this. Do you see in the near future any major changes in this area that would be of some relief to the taxpayer, particularly in the federal aid to the dependent children program?
Well, just right now, what is the details of this particular order, law? I couldn't recall, and therefore I would not want to discuss them. I do have very definite opinions about your general question, and I do not believe that we should be pressing our welfare problems more and more to Washington. I believe we ought to take them more to ourselves. I believe they'll be done better, more sympathetically, and more in accordance with the needs, not merely the people that are helpless and can't help themselves, but more nearly in accordance with our own self-respect and our own concern for our helpless human beings. I just distrust this business of putting all of our welfare and relief and that kind of activity in the hands of someone who would rather make speeches than to go around and see whether someone's hungry. I just believe that's a local business.
Thank you.
Delegate Durst.
Delegate Durst of Adrian. President Eisenhower, the state of Michigan now has more than 120 executive agencies, departments, and boards. Would you have any comment on the desirability of streamlining this multiplicity of agencies? And would you have any comment on the maximum number of agencies that a chief executive can efficiently administer?
Well, of course, when you have 120, that is my opinion. I hope that I'm not criticized for my opinions. That's an absurdity. If, in other words, if you're going to have good people running those, and the chief executive is going to take real interest in them, well, then it can't be done. If, on the other hand, they are of minor importance and are related to others, any principle, sound logic applied to the a matter of organization would group some of them under a man that a governor or the president could deal with. Now, this is a matter, strangely enough, that has been argued and talked and discussed in staff schools of military organisms since the time of Caesar. How many men can the high commander handle? This limits the number of corps, and you have, number of divisions you have in a corps, the number of regiments or brigades you have in a division. Finally, the number of separate commands that the very highest commander, say in a whole theater, can have. And this particular principle or consideration or factor in organization applies everywhere. How much can the top man do efficiently and get it done? And I think we must start on with this solution to the problem. How good are the men you get really around you? Are you getting political hacks and someone that thinks he's being helped? Or are you getting people that can really serve the people of the state? That's what you want. And if you get enough of those, I'd say, and I'm just guessing offhand, there should be not over 7 or 8 of those who are really in the top, and they will have a supervision under properly grouped agencies under them. And that would be, now, as a matter of fact, on this matter, the federal government has got many, many so-called independent agencies. Now, those that belong to the governor, legislature, are, of course, there's nothing that any executive can do that about that. But, I mean, the ICC and the FCC, all those things. They are set up separately and they're there. Although I don't believe in them particularly. I believe there should be an executive responsibility toward them too. But the others in the federal government are largely grouped
so that they're put under some secretary who has a large interest in their welfare. So I'd say 120 ought to be grouped together so you can certainly handle them with through 7 to 10 people.
Thank you, sir.
Delegate Faxon.
Jack Faxon, 5th Senatorial District, Wayne County. This is in line with this last question with regard to these executive agencies. Would you see the need for a state to go into areas of responsibility which the federal government already has stepped into, such as in governmental agencies regulating business activities or, say, in the area of civil rights? And if so, what recommendations would you make?
Well, in the case of civil rights, assuming that all state constitutions must accord in their general principles with the national, this is a matter for all our people, and that means the federal government. The federal government must do its best to see that equal rights guaranteed by the Constitution are given and accorded to every individual in the whole nation. But when it comes to this business of concurrent jurisdiction or some conflict of jurisdiction, this became a very troublesome problem during my administrations. One of them was this. There was, I believe, the state of Pennsylvania convicted somebody of communism, some communist association and so on, and the Supreme Court ruled that the Congress had preempted the field in this matter, and that a state had no authority of any kind to punish a man for communist actions. Well, this was, I was about horror stricken, because I didn't believe that any free nation and any governing element of any part would be stopped from looking into this matter of communism and taking action. But then the Congress finally, they told me that there was no thought, the leaders told me, there was no thought at the time of the passage of that act that they were preempting. They thought everybody had a right to look in it. But now they decided to establish a practice, which may have been abandoned or may not, I don't know, that each law passed by the Congress should stay, whether or not there was any intent to preempt the field, or whether the state should have the right to take concurrent jurisdiction. My own feeling would be, if I had the honor of sitting here as one of these delegates, I'd say I would want to define our rights and our authorities, and if the Congress had already preempted some of them, my fight would be through, your state's attorney, I don't know who else, but go and make a suit and try to get it back. That's what I'd do. Or if I couldn't do that again, I'd go back to my old scheme of a national constitutional convention. I believe you're not going to do these things and be satisfied you've done these things correctly unless you're ready to stand right up and be counted and fight right down to the last ditch.
Mrs. Judd.
I'll come to you next.
Rapids, General Eisenhower. I believe that this convention is consciously engaged in doing just what you suggest, of attempting to strengthen our state and local governments, in large part to retard the growing reliance of local government on Washington and to preserve our federal system of government. However, it has puzzled me as to just what we as a single state can accomplish in this direction. Now, you've answered my question in part with regard to the effect of our leadership on other states, but could you tell us something of the possible movements in other states to modernize their constitutions also?
No, as a matter of fact, I must say this one was the one I'd first heard of, and it's the reason that without any quarrel I accepted the invitation to come here, because not that I thought I could give you people any particularly worthwhile counsel, but if coming here could publicize a little bit better what you people are trying to do, I'm all for it. And that's the real reason of my being here. Now, I should make this clear. There are certain things that are going to Congress now by laws, which can be, and those with those changed, you can get back your traditional authority and responsibility in these fields. If wherever there has been an interpretation of the Constitution you think is not quite correct, then you would have to make that change by getting a constitutional convention. That's all. But I believe that your example, your fighting for the laws that have been that you think are wrong in the in the federal area, and finally keep in driving for other states to join you is the only way you can do it.
Thank you, sir.
Delegate Norris.
General Eisenhower, you touched upon the subject matter very briefly, but I would like to ask the specific question, sir. During your presidency, you appointed a commission on national gold. This commission reported the following in 1960. Respect for the individual means respect for every individual. Every man and woman must have equal rights before the law and an equal opportunity to vote, to be educated, to get a job, to buy a home. These goals, which are at the core of our system, must be achieved by action at all levels. End of quote, sir. Do you not believe that action at all levels to secure equal opportunity for employment, housing, and education includes appropriate expression in a state constitution? And would not a clear-cut expression at the level of state government on behalf of such equal opportunity be helpful in strengthening America's moral position in the world?
Well, I think it's an essential, because I believe this. I believe that every individual in this room establishes possesses moral responsibility in this field. We are citizens of a free nation, and wherever we impinge upon or diminish the freedom of another individual, you impinge on your own. I believe that self-interest demands that every single individual put himself four square on this principle. Certainly it is it's certainly implied and stated in as solemnly as it can be in the Constitution. I see no reason for any state from refraining from making such a declaration. I would be very much in favor of it.
Now, it happens that we had a preponderance of Republican questions submitted to the committee. In fairness, it seems to me that in the brief time we have remaining, that we ought to give Democratic delegates a little priority in asking questions from the floor. I've had three additional questions sent up to me, but they also are from Republican delegates, and I'm therefore going to see if there are any questions from Democratic delegates that they'd like to ask. Now, I recognize Delegate Snyder.
Romney, Delegate Joe Snyder from St. Clair Shores, Macomb County. Mr. President, with improved technological processes and with people getting older, what are our responsibilities at this constitutional convention to help those who have reached the years of life where they cannot find a proper employment and they have not had the availability of resources to provide them through their end of their lives?
Well, of course, I believe in many of our industrial organizations, we've already got the pension and retirement systems, and of course, and we have the OESI, all that sort of thing. They are not adequate, particularly where emergency strikes. I believe that we should sponsor a voluntary plans for insurance in this field, and at making the state the agent, rather the federal government, but the federal government participating wherever it can be shown the need, for the simple reason, as your governor pointed out to me this morning when we were riding in, a state boundary is not anything as sacrosanct. People can come in who can be indigent, old, sick, far in greater than the proportion that are in many others. Therefore, you have a bigger problem. But I must, you point out, the technology is making us all older. Also, I think it's giving us a greater span of useless, of useful life. We have been talking at the, because we are having automation coming along, we've been talking all the time about shorter periods of active service. I doubt that this is the answer. I believe that old people can be used. I'm very sensitive about this point. And maybe we have to, in our industries, in our whole social arrangements, our lives, maybe we have to study more what is the kind of thing that older people ought to be doing, and so on down the line. So while I believe that we must, give help in terms of subsistence and proper medical care, and as far as possible on a voluntary basis, but make sure they have it, I think also we ought to be studying this whole problem: how is a population best employed, and not to get so many of these arbitrary laws that 60 you're done. And as a matter of fact, my friends, at 62 I was nominated for the presidency. Now I don't think I was completely useless, even if I if the calendar would have said so.
Delegate Binkowski.
Delegate Binkowski, 2nd Senatorial District, representing part of the east side of Detroit and Hamtramck. General, do you believe that a limitation on the term of governor, such as a two-term limitation, is advisable?
I didn't quite understand. Did you, a limitation of two terms?
Yes, General.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've felt this about, let's go back to the presidency. Naturally, at my age, I certainly was never going to run for the presidency again. I don't care what the Constitution said. So I could study and examine this question very objectively. I believe, in the case of the president, that the weight of evidence is on the side of limiting it. I mean, the weight of the of logic is on that side, because of the possibility that you take the president, who is also the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, who is really certainly the most powerful individual and occupying the most powerful office in the free world, there's always possibilities of a development in that area that we wouldn't want to have. Then I studied along with that, I must say, should we limit the length of the number of years that a senator could serve? Because if you do it with the president, should you do with a senator and a congressman? Now, I think there might be some advantages of that, but I don't believe it's a good thing, because there you have a proliferation, again, of authority. One man stays one term, another fellow stays 20 terms in the House. This is so I don't think the same thing applies. When you come to the governor, I really am not qualified to talk, but I do think that in our state, in my state, we have one term. One term and he's out. I think that's certainly too short, but I believe you might make a reasonable number of years, 8 years or something that kind, 10 years, say that's the limit. I would believe that you wouldn't want ever to see in a state
some kind of a machine hold of a popular election that could just on that, by that very fact, perpetuate a man in office. And actually, I don't think the question is too important, because there's not many Americans, I think, that would have that kind of venal ambition.
Thank you.
I'm going to have to exercise a pocket veto over the other questions that have been sent up, because we're 10 minutes behind schedule. I'm sure we all appreciate General Eisenhower's willingness to answer questions as he has. I'm sure also that we would like to have him take with him at least some symbolic mementos of our appreciation of the effort he has made to be with us on this occasion. I believe I voice the attitude of all of us in saying that we are grateful to him for sharing with us his wisdom and his great integrity, and that we appreciate not only what he has done here for us today, but what he has done throughout his life, both in war and peace. And General Eisenhower, on behalf of the delegates, I would like to present you with a gavel, which after all is a symbol of democratic society, and also an engraved copy of our Michigan Constitutional Convention handbook, and express our heartfelt appreciation. Thank you.
Leaving the rostrum, General Eisenhower indicated some question as to just what was expected of him, but now he is proceeding out through the center aisle of the convention hall here, the route through which he entered the auditorium. In the early preparations, there had been a plan under which the general would shake hands with the delegates as they filed past him. Apparently that has been dropped. Convention, Stephen Nisbet is about to call the convention back to order for the purpose of dismissing them for this session. They will resume this afternoon.
I might say to the convention that sometimes even the best laid plans go awry. The question of time entered into the picture. The general is on a very tight schedule. He did take a little longer time answering questions than we planned on. He has another appointment that he must make. I think we're all grateful that he could be with us today. Sherman will now call upon Delegate Davis.
Mr. President, I move that we recess this convention until 2:30 p.m. this afternoon.
Questions on recess? Questions on recess until 2:30. The hour is a little different, but because of the convention procedure and because of the convention this morning, it was necessary to put it at 2:30. I hope you will agree. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. It is carried. We are recessed until 2:30.
Here in Convention Hall, the security provisions were very strict. The delegates on the floor, their guests, one per delegate in the gallery, and the newsmen were the only ones in the convention hall end of the building, as a matter of fact. So the entire presentation for the public was in the hands of the press, radio, and television. WKAR Radio and WMSB Television originated this telecast.